This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in the space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the July 25th, 2009 edition of Space Talk. I'm Jim Behnke, and welcome aboard to this voyage discussing all topics related to the space program. If you want to talk about the next launch, the current shuttle mission, or when you might get your own ticket to be a space tourist, all that and more is fair game on this weekly program right here on WMMB. You can join the fun by dialing 768-1240 or star 1240 if you're an AT&T wireless customer right here on Florida's Space Coast. If you're out of town or out of the world for that matter, you can reach us long distance, 321-768-1240. Is there such a thing as long distance anymore? Or send us email to spacetalking@AOL.com. That's right, spacetalking@AOL.com. We monitor AOL during the program, and we're happy to take your questions that way as well. Today we're going to wrap up our recognition of the 40th anniversary of the first lunar landing mission, Apollo 11. We'll have a couple of guests to help us do that. One whose work I hope you know, and one whose voice I'll bet you've heard before. And we'll leave you with that tease for just a moment. But let's first take a moment and update you on some of the things happening in space this week. In fact, maybe even happening on board the International Space Station right now, where Space Shuttle Endeavour remains docked. The 13 crew members there are actually enjoying a day off today. Saturday, a down day for them after spending the last 10 days getting a lot of work done. So far, four of the five spacewalks have taken place. They've installed the Japanese back porch, that unpressurized experiment platform that is attached to the Japanese science laboratory. They've installed some spare parts on the outside of the space station and have transferred supplies, brought back some garbage from the space station into the shuttle and such, and have officially done a crew exchange where one of the astronauts is going up to stay on the space station and they're bringing someone home. Now, speaking of coming home, looking ahead to this week, it remains another busy week for Endeavour. One more week left in their mission. Looking ahead, they will have one more spacewalk on Monday, and then Endeavour will undock on Tuesday, actually a day sooner than first planned, but because of the delays in getting Endeavour off the ground, they had to replan the mission a little bit because a Russian Progress supply vehicle has to dock with the space station on Wednesday. It actually launched from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan yesterday morning successfully. And so that robot supply ship is on its way to the station and will dock on Wednesday. So Endeavour will clear the way for that to happen on Tuesday. And then by the time they get to Thursday, Endeavour's crew will go through the standard pre-landing checkouts, fire all their thrusters, work the hydraulic systems, and do those final preparations for landing, and come home to the Kennedy Space Center, hopefully Friday. The plan right now for a landing at 10:52 a.m. Eastern Time here at the Kennedy Space Center, and the weather, generally speaking, that early in the morning has been pretty good, and of course they'll watch it carefully, and we'll see what happens. But again, we hope that Endeavour comes home safely on Friday. By the time we do next week's Space Talk, hopefully we'll be talking about the conclusion of that mission. So far, so good for the mission STS-127, actually the 127th flight of the space shuttle into orbit. So that's what's going on in space right now in terms of low Earth orbit. The other big kind of news for the week happening much farther out in space at the planet Jupiter. The planet Jupiter was hit last week, last Sunday night, or at least it was first discovered last Sunday night, that a comet or perhaps an asteroid slammed into the planet and made a little mark on the planet, actually a pretty big one. An amateur astronomer in Australia named Anthony Wesley was looking at the planet Jupiter last Sunday, and he noticed this dark smudge on the planet where there wasn't one there before. And so, again, what we think happened is that an asteroid or a comet, about the size NASA estimates as being the size of three football fields, went into the planet's gaseous upper atmosphere. Now, remember, Jupiter's not a planet like Earth. It's when we see the planet Jupiter in those beautiful pictures, we're seeing the very top of clouds. Jupiter's a gas giant, and as you get deeper and deeper into the planet, those clouds start thickening and go through a bunch of phase changes. But what we're seeing at the very top are just the surface of the clouds. Well, this giant asteroid, comet, whatever it was, and I say giant relatively speaking, again, about 3 football fields in size, went into the top of the clouds and ejected material from beneath the layers, the lower layers, up into the top, and that's what give you this kind of smudge, this dark spot. This happened 15 years ago, in fact, this very week, when the comet Shoemaker-Levy hit Jupiter and made a lot of news in astronomy because, again, the Hubble Space Telescope was looking at it. We were waiting for it to happen. The comet, in fact, had passed by the solar system before, and Jupiter's gravity actually tore this thing apart and altered its gravity so that the next time it came in, we knew that it was going to go hit the planet, and everyone was waiting for it to happen. Well, in this case, this was found on Sunday by this astronomer in Australia, and the word spread through the astronomy community. And on Thursday, by the time we got to Thursday, the folks that run the NASA Hubble Space Telescope was able to point Hubble at Jupiter and capture a rather remarkable image of this smudge on the planet. Now, that in of itself is cool. In fact, I will post the picture on our Space Talk webpage later tonight. But the other neat thing about what happened was is that Hubble was still in the middle of its checkout period following the servicing and repair mission that Endeavour did during May. The Endeavour crew went up and serviced Hubble and installed this new wide-field planetary camera. And with that camera in place and still going through checkouts, about two-thirds to three-fourths of the way complete, this opportunity comes up, and bang, they just say, let's drop everything and let's point this thing and make it happen. And they did, and they got this remarkable image. So that's kind of the big news in Jupiter right now. The smudge is still there. A larger, decent amateur telescope in your backyard, if you've got one, you can probably still see it. I think if you were to, I was wondering if the BCC Planetarium would be open late enough tonight. Jupiter's in our sky kind of late at night, and I don't think they're open late enough, and that even assumes that the clouds wouldn't get in the way. But if there's an opportunity and you're interested in this and there's an opportunity to see it, I would invite you to take advantage of it. It's only the second time in history that we've been able to actually record and see this evidence of such a massive hit on a planet. And, of course, we're keeping an eye on other asteroids to make sure they don't hit us sometime as well. Hey, before we get any further, I see that Jim from West Melbourne is waiting on the line, and we do have a couple of minutes to take a quick phone call at 768-1240. Jim, you have a question. Let's hear it.
Hey, Jimmy, who was at the controls steering the LEM on Apollo 11, Neil Armstrong or the other guy?
The other guy, Buzz Aldrin.
Buzz Aldrin was steering that thing.
No, he wasn't. It was Neil Armstrong.
That's better, okay.
The commander, it's one of those interesting nomenclatures at the astronauts because you don't want to call the other guy just an assistant or whatnot, So the commander actually flew the lunar module to landing, and the lunar module pilot, generally in charge of the lunar module systems, but the commander was always at the controls. In the same way in the space shuttle, and I hear this every once in a while in the media where they say the pilot landed. Well, the commander lands the space shuttle. The pilot of the flight is in the right seat and does the other work from there. So that's it. Thanks for the phone call. I appreciate that comment. Shuttle Endeavour in space, Jupiter in space, lots going on. And we've still got more to talk about in terms of the Apollo anniversary. We're going to have a couple of guests on here now in the next segment and later in the hour that we're going to talk about Apollo 11 from a couple of different perspectives. And we invite you to stick around and listen to us. Give us a call at 321-768-1240. If you've got friends outside the Space Coast that want to listen in, give them a call right now and tell them they can listen at WMMBAM.com. In the meantime, I am Jim Banky, and this is Space Talk on WMMB. We'll be back in just a moment.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240 and star 1240 for AT&T wireless customers.
During these troubled economic times, you may have questions about your financial future. The experts at FPT Services in Rockledge have the answers. They'll listen to you, develop a custom plan, and work as your partner with a full array of financial and estate planning services. Don't wait for the economy to recover. Call FPT Services in Rockledge at 631-0383. That's 631-0383. Find them online at fptservices.com.
And now back to Space Talk on WMMB.
Good afternoon, everybody. Jim Banky here with Space Talk on WMMB. I encourage you to call in right now, 321-768-1240. Line it up, star 1240 for your local AT&T wireless customers, or send us email at spacetalking@AOL.com. Well, we're happy to have our first guest with us on the line. We're going to introduce him here right now. His name is Andrew Chaikin. We'll call him Andy today. Andy's a good friend going way back, and he and I have very similar backgrounds that took slightly different paths. I grew up in Minnesota and grew up watching Apollo on one TV channel and Star Trek reruns on the other, and through a very long story I'll tell someday, I wind up here on Florida Space Coast, and here we are after all these years doing this program. Andy also grew up with the space program, and he took a little different path that we'll let him tell you in just a minute. And now he also has become an accomplished writer and author about the space program. In fact, I'm a little jealous of him that he did the Apollo book before I ever thought to do it. He wrote the book A Man on the Moon, which is now the definitive book about the entire Apollo program, author Andy Chaikin. In fact, this book became the basis for the Tom Hanks HBO miniseries From the Earth to the Moon. So if you ever watch that series and you want to know where all that good material came from, Andy Chaikin's the guy. And in fact, now for this year, the 40th anniversary of Apollo 11, he wrote a brand new book, which we'll let him tell us about in just a second. And Andy, you there? You on the line?
Hey, Jim.
Hey, Andy. How are you?
Congratulations on the show.
Good, thanks. And congratulations for the new book. Let's spend a couple of quick minutes talking about that. Tell us how this Voices on the Moon thing took place and what's it all about.
Well, you know, when I wrote A Man on the Moon, I spent over 150 hours talking to 23 of the 24 Apollo lunar astronauts. The only one I didn't talk to was Jack Swigert, who had died in 1982. But all the others, you know, Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, Pete Conrad, Alan Shepard, I sat down with them at great length and asked them about every possible detail of the experience of going to the moon. But A Man on the Moon was not the kind of book where I let the astronauts speak directly to the reader. It was a narrative. But now what I've done, my wife Victoria Cole and I have put together Voices from the Moon is a collection of quotes from those interviews, and they are together, they tell the whole arc of that experience, that otherworldly experience that only these 23 out of 24 human beings have had.
The book is very neatly organized. When I first heard about it, I thought, okay, well, he's going to show all the Pete Conrad in your quotes, and then he's going to do all the Neil Armstrong quotes. But no, you spread them all out over the course of this whole book, illustrated with some of the best pictures ever pulled and collected in one spot of the Apollo program. And like you say, in the arc, you tell the whole story. What do they all feel like at launch? What do they all feel like on the moon? And again, it's some of these quotes are feeling, emotion questions. You don't get that from test pilot engineers.
Well, that's the whole thing. You know, as Vicky and I say in our preface, you know, when these guys came back from the moon, we all handed them a mission that they had never trained for, which was to explain what it felt like to be there. And that was not something that they were necessarily comfortable with. I mean, test pilots, you know, if you're flying a high-performance jet or a spacecraft, feelings can kill you if you let them get in the way.
Right.
But these guys had schooled themselves not to spend time thinking about what they felt, and they were also from a generation, you know, born in the 1930s, most of them, that were not in the habit of plumbing the depths of their own feelings. But I have to say that when I sat down with them, and especially given, you know, a few hours to kind of get into it in detail, they really came through. And I think you see that in the book.
Oh, I think you absolutely do. And you talk about the generation. Now, you and I come from a little bit later generation. Talk to me a little bit about how you grew up. What was your youth like, and how did you wind up doing what you're doing now and taking a pit stop at JPL on the way?
Yeah, the pit stop at JPL was my college experience as an intern on the Viking Mars landing, and that was just one of the great fortunes I had of going to Brown University and having as my advisor Dr. Thomas A. Much, M-U-T-C-H, who was the team leader for the lander imaging team on Viking and had helped create an intern program with NASA. So, yeah, I spent three summers at JPL during college and got kind of a ground's-eye view of how you do a space mission. But at the same time, I realized that I didn't want to be a space scientist like I thought I did. And it was only a couple of years after college that I kind of, almost by accident, I moved to Boston. I wanted to find a job that was space-related, and one of my professors suggested calling Sky and Telescope magazine, and I joined their staff to work on a book about the solar system called The New Solar System, then became one of their editors, and then a few years later, I was thinking about writing a book, and it didn't take me long to return to Apollo, which I'd been completely in love with as a kid and watched all the missions. You know, I watched... Apollo started when I was in junior high, and it ended when I was in high school. So I was just the right age, I think, to kind of be a vicarious participant in that adventure. And then I used all of those memories when I was riding a man on the moon. Those all played in.
The Apollo program was such a rarity in our history. What's your perspective now, especially we've gone through the whole anniversary thing now this past week, and a lot of people are waxing poetic about it. What's your sense about the meaning of Apollo and what it means, and where do we need to be heading next?
Well, I think Apollo stands as in a number of ways. First of all, it was probably the greatest group achievement in history, certainly the technological achievement of the millennium, but it really was the combined efforts of 400,000 people who worked for the better part of a decade to make something that seemed impossible a reality. You know, they turned the moon from a light in the sky into a destination. And so that's a tremendously inspiring thing that I think still resonates, still has great power. You know, the astronauts were just the tip of the spear, but without those 400,000 people, they would never have gotten to the moon. Scientifically, Apollo was spectacular. We discovered a world that has an incredible story to tell. You know, the very early history of the solar system is preserved on the moon better than anywhere else. That's why I always say that going to the moon is like somebody let you into the rare book room of the cosmic library. It gave us a leap in awareness when we look back at our own planet. What I call the Apollo perspective, I think, is Apollo's greatest legacy. And, you know, it shows that when you explore, you know, very often the biggest benefit you get from exploration is something you didn't even anticipate when you left.
Right.
You know, looking back at the Earth and gaining new awareness of its very finite, precious, even fragile nature was not on the flight plan. But that, in fact, was the greatest, you know, benefit that I think we got from Apollo.
Now going back to you talk about some emotions and stuff, and we you and I both grew up where these guys were our heroes, and not you mentioned the others, not just the astronauts, but even the flight directors, the managers, the launch conductors, all of these guys were our heroes growing up. And like me, you have gotten a chance to grow up and get to know these guys as personal friends. And
right.
And some of that is reflected in your New Voices book. It's just them, but the way you caringly put it together. Talk about, we don't have time to talk about all 24 Apollo astronauts that walked or that were part of the program. But tell us, since we're talking about Apollo 11, talk about Neil, Mike, and Buzz. What three different guys they are, and what a great crew they met.
Oh, boy, they really are so different. They're so different. I mean, Mike has this very dry, self-deprecating sense of humor. You know, he talks about the fame that goes along with being a moon astronaut as a negative, but there's a great positive, obviously, from having been the satisfaction of accomplishing something like that. Also, the fact that you come back from the moon and you're 38 years old, and you know you've done the most exciting thing you'll ever do in your life, and you know he talks about that as a small negative compared to the positive of going through life and having somebody say, hey, that guy flew to the moon.
That's right.
You know, and the satisfaction of having accomplished that. Neil. And Mike, by the way, you know, his bumper sticker is lucky.
Yeah.
He says, put that on my tombstone, I'm lucky.
Right.
Neil is one of the things I love about Neil is his constant. He's grounded in history. He is so aware of the sweep of history. He is so aware of how he is just one, you know, person that fits into this great progression of innovation and accomplishment. You know, when he went to the moon, he brought along with him a piece of the Wright Flyer.
Yeah.
And not only because he's from Ohio and so are the Wright brothers, but because, you know, he sees and saw then the moon landing on a continuum with what the Wright brothers accomplished. You know, you're looking at one of the most inspiring examples of human intellect and drive and determination to achieve an immortal dream of flight and then leaving our planet.
Andy, with about 40 seconds left, tell us quick about Buzz.
Well, Buzz has had a hard time, you know, because of his manic depressive illness and his alcoholism. He's really struggled to overcome that stuff, and he has. And he's very passionate about getting us forward in space. And I do disagree with him. I think the moon is a spectacular place to go back to, and we've barely scratched the surface of what it has to tell us. But I agree with him in that we should be going to Mars in the long term, and I hope we live to see that happen.
10 seconds. What's the next book?
Possibly The Impact Threat. I may be co-authoring a book with Rusty Schweikart on the asteroid impact threat.
And a good week to do that with Jupiter Pictures fresh off the press. Andy, thanks for your time. I know you're getting ready to go on a flight.
We'll do it again.
We'll talk to you again. Okay, thanks, Andy. Hey, when we come back, we'll be joined by Jack King, the voice of Apollo 11 launch control from the Kennedy Space Center on Apollo 11. And all that and your questions and comments when we come back from Space Talk on WMMB.
Listen to Space Talk on the web at WMMBAM.com. If it's happening in space, Jim Behnke is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
Good afternoon, everybody. The second half of this week's Space Talk coming right at you. I'm here firmly on the ground, your host, Jim Behnke, inviting you to participate in the program by calling 321-768-1240 or locally here, star 1240 on your AT&T wireless cell phone. And be sure to visit the Space Talk webpage at WMMBAM.com and use the keywords Space Talk and you'll get to our page and follow along with what we're doing here during the week. Before we move on to Jack King, speaking of someone participating by calling in, Matt from Patrick Air Force Base, I believe, is here and has a question.
Hey, how you doing, Jim? Great program, by the way.
Good, thanks. What's up?
Okay, well, I only had two questions, but then I thought of a third one, and I will ask the questions and then get off the air.
Okay.
And last week you talked about how much we paid to ride up on the Russian spaceship.
Sure,
now,
yeah.
How much do the other countries pay us to ride on the shuttle?
Okay.
And number two is the elder astronaut said that we should skip the moon and go straight to Mars.
Right.
And then the third question is, as I watched the shuttle ride home on the 747 the last time, you know, I just kind of thought, if they had an emergency, can they dump the shuttle? Or do the crew have ejection seats to get out of it? And I'm going to hang up and let you answer.
Okay. We could probably do a whole hour on some of the topics that you brought up. But, Matt, thanks for the call. Okay, really quickly, do others pay, international people pay for rides on the space shuttle? Not directly, not in the way that you're thinking about, but generally what's happening is that our international partners are contributing large amounts of money and hardware to the program. And as part of that partnership, as part of that agreement for us carrying their stuff up, we often take people up from their countries as well to help operate the equipment that they're contributing. So it's an international partnership deal. It's not so much an out-and-out commercial cash for tickets for seats kind of thing. In terms of the skipping moon and going right to Mars, you just heard Andy Chaikin say the same thing that I think I personally believe is that our goal in space needs to be out there, period. And we need to go as far out and as far as we can, as quickly as we can. We as a human species must survive, and the only way we're going to do that is to eventually leave this planet. So the moon was not a destination. Mars is not a destination. It is simply stepping stones on the way heading out. So I believe to get to Mars, we need to do some tests at the moon first. That does not mean I don't want to go to Mars. I want to go to Mars, and I want to get there as fast as I can. But we need to stop at the moon first to do some tests and figure out how we're going to live on Mars before we're ready to go there. In terms of the 747, when the shuttle comes back on the 747, there's no one on board the shuttle and only the regular pilots in the 747. So if there's an emergency and it's the bad day, they're all going down. There's no way for them no way for them to eject. If they're going to go down, they're going to go down. The bigger concern with the shuttle, of course, is just getting it back here safely. And that's always the top priority. Now, in the old days when they tested the shuttle by flying it off the 747, they actually could detach the shuttle. There were actually astronauts on board, and at that time they did have ejection seats in the shuttle. But those have long since been removed, not only from the test vehicle but from the operational vehicles as well. So, Matt, thanks for that. And we can talk about that more on another edition of Space Talk, and I'll take some notes, and maybe we'll get back into that. In the meantime, let's keep talking about Apollo 11. My good buddy Jack King is standing by. He lives in Titusville, is a longtime Space Coast resident who now works for the United Space Alliance. But 40 years ago, on July 16th, 1969, he was in the firing room at the Kennedy Space Center calling the countdown to Apollo 11, and it sounded something like this.
40 seconds away from the Apollo 11 liftoff. All the second stage tanks now pressurized. 35 seconds and counting. We are still go with Apollo 11. 30 seconds and counting. Astronauts report it feels good. T-minus 25 seconds. 20 seconds and counting. T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence starts. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11. Tower cleared.
We got a roll program.
Jack King, welcome to Space Talk.
Hey, Jim. Good to be here.
Good to have you here, sir. And, you know, listening to that, I never get tired of it. I hear something different every time I listen. Sometimes I think those seconds are ticking off way too slow. And other times I'm thinking you're just doing this all on one breath. And,
that's right.
And other times I'm thinking you can't believe you're actually saying all engines running and liftoff.
Well, actually, one of the things there is both all the news media and the particularly the television folks. At the start of the Apollo program, they requested that I really tuck the countdown down, starting at the 3 minute and 10 second mark.
Mm-hmm.
That's when we got firing command, and that's when there were so many things going on the Saturn V rocket that it was too much for human comprehension, and the computers took over. We had a big RCA-110A computer in the firing room,
mm-hmm.
and a second one in the mobile launcher at the pad. And so that was the reason I talked it down at the request of all of those folks.
And so you get down to that moment, and it's about to happen. And now we had Al Warden on a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about, well, every one mission to the next mission is all the same, and you know, and maybe the historical context didn't really hit anybody till long after. But you're in a little different business. Your brain operates a little bit differently than a test pilot. Were you aware of the history being made? Were you conscious of that, or did that have to wait for you as well?
Oh, sure, if you want me to cover a little bit. By the way, putting me on after Andy Shakin is quite a challenge. But we'll see what happens here. First off, I want to say in any remarks that I'm very proud to have the opportunity to represent the outstanding launch team that conducted that historic mission.
Oh, yeah.
And remembering very well. Actually, I live in Cocoa Beach, as a matter of fact, Jim. and did at that time, and kissed my wife goodbye about midnight because I wanted to get out in time for the tanking procedures, which are very similar in a general concept to what goes on with the shuttle today. The main event over the last 9 hours with the Saturn V was to load those thousands of gallons of liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen on board the three stages of the Saturn V rocket. Driving out from Cocoa Beach, the town was vibrant at midnight. Stopped, grabbed a donut and a cup of coffee, and continued on my way. As I went through the Cape Gate, I tried to look out over the lagoon, and I couldn't see anything because all the cars, the recreation vehicles, and just all of them already lined up to get their a good opportunity to get a good sight to watch the launch. So things were very different. In fact, as you know, more than 750,000 people came into the Brevard area to view that launch. Sure. So it was quite a mad time in the old town, without any question.
So when the Saturn V lifts off and you're 3.5 miles away, and let me throw in really quick that if any of you have been out to the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex, they recreate the firing room at the Apollo Saturn V Center, and they do a recreation of actually the Apollo 8 countdown, which Jack also called. And there's a moment when the shutters start shaking and all that's going on. Is that realistic? Is that what you heard? Is that what you felt standing there 3.5 miles away?
Every time. Now, you see, Apollo 11 was our sixth Saturn V launch. So it wasn't too new to us in that degree. By that time, we certainly knew what to expect. The one that really did the job on all of us was the very first Saturn V launch, which was unmanned. And I handled all the press operations. We issued earplugs to the news media out there at that time. And that first one, I was in a newly built firing room at that time. And when the sound hit us from the Saturn V liftoff, those windows started to rattle, but also construction dust came down from the ceiling of this newly built building, and I thought for a moment the whole damn place was going to come down on top of us. And the same thing, it knocked Walter Cronkite right off his seat in the trailer at the press site. So that gives you the immensity of it. The first time was really quite a thrill and quite a shock. By the time we were launching it for the sixth time, we certainly knew what to expect.
Well, I know with the space shuttle, you don't get nearly the same kind of power when you're standing out there. I have been told by others, Jack, and maybe you can confirm this, that as the shuttle lifts off and it gets louder and louder at that press site area in the LC-39 area, there's a point where there's one kind of crackle of the SRB that gets so loud that you think that if it goes one more time, you might actually have to put your hands to your head or something. And then it just goes away so fast because the shuttle launches out of here so quickly.
That's right.
I'm told that the Saturn V, though, was that next level of loudness, and it stayed thundering for 20, 30 seconds.
Oh, yeah. I'll explain that in a minute, if I may. But to get a little background on it, our folks made intense sound studies as well as blast effect studies when we were preparing and building the facilities out there for the Saturn V. And that's how we came to the judgment that we could put the launch control center and the press site as well just about 3.5 miles from the launch pad. We actually launched from Launch Complex 39A, which is still being used now for the shuttle. And in some of the testing, it was quite amazing. They equated the sound to sitting in the front row of a hard rock band of the things to see what it'd do to your ears. And
Jack, we're gonna pause really quick right here. We're going to come back in a couple minutes, finish the story, and wrap up this edition of Space Talk. I'm Jim Behnke. You're listening to WMMB.
With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Behnke.
Good afternoon, everybody. A final segment of this edition of Space Talk coming at you. Jack King, the voice of Apollo 11 launch control, on the phone with us from his home in Cocoa Beach. Jack, we were talking before the break about the sound and the power of the Saturn V moon rocket. You were talking about doing some sound studies. Pick up your story and let's move on.
Well, actually, I think I can give you the best feeling by going through how I felt about that overall countdown and the performance of the launch team, if I may.
Sure.
Well, actually, when I got out there, of course, they were the same faces I had worked with for over 8 years. Our launch team had been together since the first Saturn I in 1961. So I saw the same faces and the same people, but underneath each one of us, there was a tremendous sense of anticipation, I know. That certainly was with me on that for that particular count.
Mm-hmm.
As it turns out, the Apollo 11 countdown was one of the smoothest countdowns we'd ever run. The tanking operation just went along smoothly. We had two minor problems, just a problem with a communications light on a panel, and something that's familiar with the shuttle these days, a slight leak in a hydrogen, liquid hydrogen replenishment valve in the third stage.
Oh, my.
But otherwise, everything clicked down beautifully, and we solved those two problems immediately. By the time dawn broke, it turned out to be a beautiful morning for a flight to the moon with hardly a cloud in the sky and a temperature of 85 degrees. Shortly thereafter, the Apollo 11 astronauts, Neil Armstrong, Mike Collins and Buzz Aldrin crossed over Swing Arm 9, boarded the spacecraft, settled in, and we continued to count down. Now, the thing that really occurred to me was as we got to the final moments of the count, the atmosphere in that firing room was electric.
Wow.
All these guys were professionals. They were doing their job, but it was like no other countdown at that particular point, and I think I can express it for the 435 people who were in there. And as we got down, you get to the real magic moments in the final count comes at the 8.9-second mark in the count mm-hmm. when those five giant engines in the first stage ignite. And it takes the further seconds in the countdown leading up to zero just for it to build up the 7.5 million pounds of thrust needed for liftoff.
Sure.
And then finally you get two cues right at the end. The first one is all engines running, which confirms that the rocket has reached its full thrust, and then commit. And the commit signal orders there are still five giant swing arms attached to the Saturn V at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And it orders those five swing arms to swing back in unison, and then it creates the hold-down arms to release, and that's the way we get liftoff.
Wow.
So I would say liftoff, and I said that, of course, very proudly on Apollo 11. And I was in the back row of the firing room, and all of a sudden, as usual with the Saturn V, I looked over my shoulder, and there is that majestic vehicle still sitting there in a bed of flames. It was always amazing to me. It seemed like an eternity before it would finally rise.
Wow.
But rise it did, and, of course, the shuttle, when it passes the tower, is going 100 miles an hour. The Saturn V, it took 7 seconds just to clear the tower.
Right. Right.
So it was quite a dramatic launch, and it was a very special one without any question.
Wow.
For us, just one final thing, for us in the control room, that was really our moment of truth, and was followed 4 days later by a moment of triumph when Neil set foot on the moon.
Well, and you didn't celebrate that launch, if you will, until they were back safely, or was there a big party yet that first night?
Oh, no party. There was a tremendous roar when the Saturn V took off, without
sure.
any question, because we weren't turning blue like they did in Houston when Neil landed, but most of the guys were a little out of breath. I couldn't be out of breath because I had to talk, but there was a tremendous relief for all of us, and so there was a certain reaction in the control room, but of course we all knew there was still a long way to go.
Oh, that's great. So now here we are 40 years later, and you lived through the lunar landing program, probably had some thoughts about where we might be now. Now, we've made some tremendous strides, but are we where you think we should be now? And or more importantly, where do you think we ought to be going next?
Well, no, I don't know how much time we have, Jim.
About 2 minutes.
Let me just mention quickly, when the program was cut short, they cut three Apollo launches out of the program, as you know, because facing the same things we're facing today, the economy, there was a tremendous fuel shortage and other things. I agreed with my boss at the time, since I worked out at Houston at that time, Chris Kraft, when the decision was made to go into low Earth orbit with the shuttle. Chris, along with a lot of others, and I agreed with it, said, gee, we're space cadets. We want to continue out.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine where we would be, if you want to look at it that way, if over the last 40 years we had continued to explore out and had the support of the American people and had the support of Congress to do it. So now here we are. The space shuttle program has been a tremendous program, without any question.
Right.
But here we are, once again, looking out and trying to make every effort to resume our exploration with an awful lot of challenges ahead.
And we'll meet those challenges. Jack, we're going to wrap it up with you there. Thank you so much for being on the air. Happy anniversary. And, you know, every time we turn over, we heard your voice during the last 10 days. So it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it happens about every 10 years or so, Jim.
Take care, Jack, okay?
Okay, thank you,
thank you,
my friend.
Thank you so much. Well, just to wrap up, some quick thoughts on Apollo 11. On Monday night, there was a big gala celebration at the National Air and Space Museum, and a bunch of speeches and comments and whatnot were made by a lot of neat people. But Neil Armstrong wrapped it all up for everybody and talked about Apollo, talked about the anniversary, talked about successes during the past 4 years, talked about what kind of lasting impression it made on everybody. But the thing that I thought was really kind of neat was the way he ended the presentation, the end of his speech, was by saying that basically Apollo left, quote, a lasting imprint on society and history. Tonight, we remember and congratulate all those who made it possible. Apollo was a good thing to do. And it certainly was. And space program is a good thing to do. Space flight's a good thing to do. And we can talk about how to get there and where to go and all that, but I just want to go. So that kind of wraps up some thinking on Apollo 11 and the anniversary. We appreciate everyone who participated in our remembrances. Looking ahead to next week, Space Talk will be back next week, hopefully the day after Shuttle Endeavour lands on Friday at 10:52 a.m. Got some guests lined up for the show on Saturday, but depending on what happens with Endeavour, we'll have to wait and see how that goes. We'll stay tuned to WMMBAM.com. for latest updates on what is going on with Space Talk, and you can certainly follow us on Twitter at Space Talking. For now, thanks for tuning in. This is Space Talk with Jim Banky on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com.